Chapter 17.
Lots of people scream,
Miller thought.
All the time, for a lot of different reasons.
It didn't have to mean the woman was in danger. He'd heard similar screams before at fraternity parties. Miller tried to reason with whatever was making the hair stand up on the back of his neck at the sound. He had the urge to crouch down, hide behind something, as if some ancestral memory was telling him, "The enemy is coming." But that made no sense. There was no enemy. At least, not on horseback. Besides, he was somewhere in the future. Wasn't it more reasonable to assume that the sound of horses meant some kind of amusement, and not primitive warriors chasing around a screaming victim? So he tried to feel casual as he turned away from the plane and walked toward the sound he'd heard, telling himself it was good news to find other people so quickly, people who could tell him where/when he was, and perhaps how to get home. Maybe the airport had fallen into ruin because these people travel through space and time nowadays. That would make sense. Cook said that they had mastered time travel in the future. Why bother with the upkeep on an airport when you could travel through time? The more Miller reasoned it out, the more certain he became that he was about to meet Cook's people. Perhaps the very contact he was supposed to have met when he landed. That made him pause for a moment. He could not hand over that artifact. There wasn't enough of it left. Would they believe his wild story about a storm? But all of that was forced out of his mind by what he saw ahead of him. At the far edge of the runway, a forest had grown up to the pavement. Bursting out of the tree line and to his left was a sight that stunned him nearly off his feet. A clot of men, perhaps half a dozen of them, ran from the trees, pell-mell. One of them paused to whirl a sling and let a rock fly at some unseen target still in the trees. The others ran as if the devil himself was after them. And other than their weapons, the men were completely naked. Naked and painted blue. Celts? But if this was the future... Three more figures raced from the trees. The first was a woman, luxurious red hair spilling across a dark, hooded garment. She held her arm as if it had been injured. The two warriors beside her kept their backs to her, facing the woods with their swords held ready. As Miller watched, one of the rearguard warriors fell, an arrow sprouting from his chest, and the last one turned to urge on the woman. Then, with a blood-curdling yell, he charged back into the trees, waving his sword. The woman hesitated for a second, and called after him. But even from this distance, Miller could hear the yells and the clash of steel just within the tree line. In the meantime, one man in the small group of warriors in the front turned and came racing back to the woman. As the woman tried to step back toward the trees, he grabbed her, threw her over one huge shoulder, and ran for his comrades. Moments later, a line of horsemen burst from the wood to bear down on the Celts, and once again Miller held his breath, feeling dizzy and completely lost. Because the silhouette of this new group was unmistakable. From the sharply protruding armor on the shoulders, and the angled horns on their helmets, down to the distinctive leggings and the banners flapping behind them, there could be no doubt of who they were. Samurai warriors. Samurai warriors chasing a group of primitive Celts. And the whole melee was headed straight at him. There was a time to analyze and wonder, and a time to run for your life. Miller had absolutely no doubt that right now was a prime example of the second option. He turned and ran for the plane. The soreness in his muscles had magically disappeared. He dove back through the pilot's door and began to scrabble through the plane for some kind of weapon. Anything at all. Ah! The flare gun! Where was it? Damn, had he left it buried in the sand on Yuki's island? No, he remembered it distinctly. He loaded it into the plane, stowed it behind the water jug. He fumbled the 2-gallon water container out of the way, dropping it onto his toe. He cursed at the pain. But there was the flare gun! Miller grabbed for the gun and the small bag of shotgun shell-shaped cartridges. Only 4 left. With trembling fingers, he shoved the cartridge into the gun, put the spares into his shirt pocket, and thrust the gun into his waistband, and climbed back into the pilot's seat. And as Miller popped into view in the cockpit, so did a head of flaming red hair. The woman in the robe, the one who had been carried from the woods, was beside the airplane now. Her burly companion set her down and, as Miller appeared, the man stared at him. Miller held up his hands and tried to think of what he might say to assure the man of his peaceful intentions. "Pax," was all he could blurt out. It was enough. The warrior shoved the red-haired woman at Miller, panting out an amazingly lyrical-sounding sentence, and ran back toward the charging samurai. As he ran, he pulled a sword from his baldric and swung it over his head with an ululating war cry. That is a word, by the way. I looked it up. Miller jumped down from the plane and held out a hesitant hand toward the woman. She did not even see him. Instead, still holding a bloody wound on one arm, she focused all her attention on her warrior. Miller turned to watch, too. The warrior made it no more than 50 feet before the first samurai was on him. The Celt raised his sword and began to shout a challenge. The samurai, who seemed unarmed, halted his horse in front of the Celt. With amazing speed, he reached behind his neck. A gleaming long sword appeared. A flash of light arced toward the Celt, and in the blink of an eye, the other warrior's head was rolling across the ground. His headless corpse tottered for a few seconds, spouting blood from the neck, and then toppled over. The woman beside Miller gasped, a look of horror on her beautiful face. She stepped forward, a shout of rage forming on her lips, and raised her arms, the injured one with some difficulty. But as she did, Miller heard the hoofbeats again. Beyond the samurai, the rest of his troop was galloping into view. Miller took the woman by the waist and swung her down into the slim protection offered by the airplane. She hissed at him.
"Please,"
he whispered.
"I can't fight them all, and neither can you."
She didn't understand, of course, but she didn't shout or stand up either. The cluster of samurai thundered by on their horses, chasing the fleeing line of Celts. They did not appear to notice Miller and the woman. The samurai with the sword got off his horse and lifted the warrior's head from the ground by its hair. He examined it, appeared pleased with it, especially the long blonde mustache, and hung it from his saddle. It was too much for the woman. She slipped out from under Miller's arms and stepped away from the plane toward the samurai with the head. She raised her arms above her head and began to chant. Miller couldn't understand the words, but the tone was clear. It was a curse. The samurai watched her for a moment, amused. Then he sheathed his sword, carefully wiping the blood off the blade on his tunic. He turned to the horse and took down a bow and quiver of arrows. He knocked a shaft. The woman slammed her wrists together, ignoring what must have been considerable pain from the wounded arm, and shouted a series of syllables. As her voice lifted on the last syllable, the samurai's horse reared, whinnying. It ran its shoulder into the samurai, knocking him down, and galloped madly away, eyes rolling.
"How the hell?"
Miller said in amazement. But the samurai was back on his feet, knocking the arrow again and aiming at the woman. With a bellow, Miller dove for her. As he swept an arm at her legs and knocked her to the ground as the arrow whipped through the space where her head had been, there was a spong thunk, followed by the noise of a dribbling fluid, and Miller turned to see that the arrow implanted in the plane's fuel tank. Gasoline was streaming across the cracked tarmac.
"Come on,"
he said to the woman, pulling her by the hand.
"We've got to get out of here."
She didn't resist, but she didn't help much either. Miller got the idea that dying in battle was okay with her. She was entitled to her opinion, but he didn't happen to agree. The samurai knocked another arrow. Miller pulled the woman around to the other side of the plane and crouched low to see what the warrior was doing. He was, in fact, being sensible. Miller saw his feet approaching cautiously. He was now holding his sword instead of the bow and stepping toward the plane with the razor-sharp blade held at the ready.
"This is our chance,"
Miller whispered. The woman looked back at him. Her eyes were lively, sparkling with rage and battle lust. She shook her head to indicate she hadn't understood him.
"Come,"
Miller said, again grasping her hand. She nodded and stood up, taking a deep breath. To his horror, Miller realized she was about to bellow something at the samurai, probably a challenge or an insult, and he quickly clapped a hand over her mouth.
"Shh,"
he signaled. She bit his hand. He pulled it away, shook it, then used it to show her he was unarmed.
"Look,"
he said, waving a hand at his shorts and ragged shirt.
"Nothing to fight with. Not even a big rock. We've got to make a run for it."
She looked dubious and glanced longingly in the direction of the approaching samurai.
"No,"
Miller said firmly. Urgently.
"There's no chance. Come on."
He held out his hand, nodded at the ruins of the control tower. She still looked doubtful, but did not resist when he took her arm, the good one, and led her at a quick half crouch away from the plane. Miller made for the rubble at an angle that blocked the samurai's view of them. They were only 20 feet away from the relative safety of the rubble heap when the warrior came around the tail end of the plane.
"Yame! Ainu!"
he shouted, and sheathed his sword in favor of the bow and arrow again. He took careful aim, and even at this distance, Miller knew he would not miss. One of them was about to die. The samurai paused and looked down at his feet. He shook one of them, irritated. Miller saw something splash off. He was standing in a puddle of gasoline from the punctured fuel tank. As the samurai raised his bow one last time, Miller whipped the flare gun out of his waistband and fired. It was a lousy shot. He'd meant to hit the puddle of fuel to scare the man into dropping the bow and running away with singed eyebrows. Instead, he hit the warrior squarely in the chest. The man was thrown backward from the impact of the 12-gauge flare. His whole body rolled through the pool of gasoline, his silk tunic soaking up the fuel like a sponge. In In less than a second, the man was burning like a bonfire. He made no sound at first, simply burned, stood up, fell to his knees, struggled halfway up again, and then let out something between a gasp and a squeal. As he fell over, the entire pool of spilled gasoline blossomed into an inferno. The sheet of flame raced back toward the airplane. "Run!" Miller shouted, grabbing the woman by the hand again and pulling her around to the far side of the rubble heap. They had just made it to the shelter of the fallen tower when the plane exploded. A hot wind whistled overhead, and a trickle of dirt and small rocks cascaded down the slope above them. A rock the size of a golf ball bounced off Miller's head.
"Ouch!"
he said, and the red-haired woman looked at him. Miller felt an almost physical impact from her stare. Her eyes were cat-green and alive with intelligence, compassion, and strength. She held a hand out to his head, palm first, and moved it around until she came to the spot where the rocket hit.
"It's nothing,"
he said. The woman shook her head and smiled at him. Miller smiled back and took a moment to study her. Aside from the fact that she was beautiful and seemed intelligent, there was very little he could guess about her. If she was, in fact, a Celt, then her robes would indicate that she was a druid, a learned and holy person. That would explain why her companion had willingly given his life to give her a chance to escape. Additionally, she wore a thick gold necklace, a torque, the name popped into Miller's head from his brief studies of the Celts in graduate school, which also indicated that she was a person of some rank and importance. She had been studying him, too, and now their eyes met once again. She lifted a strong and graceful hand and placed it on her chest, next to a beautifully worked brooch.
"Mara,"
she said. He gave her a small half-bow.
"Tony Miller,"
he replied, and they smiled at each other. In the distance, the sound of the battle lifted up. A huge shout, followed by the most god-awful caterwauling, wheezing noise. Then the hoofbeats came closer, closer. And as Miller and the red-haired woman peeked out around their rock and dirt barrier, the samurai warriors galloped past, back toward the forest. There seemed to be a couple of them missing, and one of the remaining warriors slumped over in his saddle, both arms folded across his stomach. The caterwauling grew closer, pursuing, and Mara stood up, yelling curses at the fleeing samurai, who galloped on without slowing or turning around, heading for the shelter of the tree line. Behind them, Miller saw their pursuers. In a steady and unhurried march, a ragged line of 50 or 60 warriors approached. In front of them came 6 or 7 others who seemed unarmed but held something at their chest. Of course! Bagpipes! That was the caterwauling. The pipers were leading the troops into battle. And now it was Mara who took Miller's hand and led him to her people. End of chapter.